here's how the story starts from Daniel Kading at WPR.org/news from a few weeks ago. Conservation advocates in Wisconsin say the Trump administration's rollback of the Endangered Species Act threatens habitat that is crucial for endangered and threatened species in our state. We're talking about this hour on the Lee Rayburn Show with two guests. We'll speak with Stan Temple, who is a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation, in a few minutes. But I want to start with Adina Rissman, who is a professor of natural resources policy and management at UW-Madison, to help explain what has happened and what we could expect next. And we invite your questions about this change to the Federal Endangered Species Act and what it could mean for the endangered and threatened plants and animals in Wisconsin. You can join our conversation at any time at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And Adina Rissman, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with a little bit of the news and what happened last month and how it happened.
Sure. So last month, the federal administration put out a new rulemaking that rescinds the definition of harm and says that harm does not include significant habitat destruction that actually kills or injures a species, which has been the longstanding definition of harm for about the last 50 years, as the two administrative agencies have implemented the Endangered Species Act, and that's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries for marine species. Here in Wisconsin, it's mostly the Fish and Wildlife Service that is involved.
So this was a rule change to the Endangered Species Act, which is a law. How was the law able to be amended with just a simple rule change? How did that happen?
So that's really important. Actually, the law has not changed. The Endangered Species Act, as you mentioned, was passed by Congress in 1973. But for every law, there's a lot of questions about how it should be implemented. And these are decided by the agencies through a rulemaking process. People can go to regulations.gov and they can look at all the things that the agencies are doing. And so it gets a little bit in the weeds, but it's pretty interesting to think about that in the law, the Endangered Species Act says we cannot take federally listed endangered fish and wildlife without a permit. And the law itself defines take to include harm. But the law does not define harm. That's what the rules do. And that's what's changed.
What was the process for redefining harm in a way that changes this Endangered Species Act to challenge the habitat of some of these plants and animals? Was this did this happen overnight? Was this years in the making? And who was behind its making as you see it, Adina?
This was years in the making. They went through what I would view as generally the normal rulemaking process of putting out a proposed rule. And that rule received 358,000 comments from across the country. So there was a lot of interest in that. And then they finalized the rule. They put out their final rule last month. And that final rule will go into effect in September coming up here.
The story I read from Daniel Kading at WPR.org says that there are some lawsuits that have been filed to challenge this rule change. What role can the courts play in this, Adina?
Well, that's going to be the big question as to whether the courts put a stop to this change or not. There have been requests for preliminary injunctions, which would stop this rule from going into effect. But it's not clear exactly what the courts will do. Long term, though, it does appear that part of the strategy would be to get this case to the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn a 1995 decision called Sweet Home that upheld the agency's discretion to define harm as including significant habitat modification or degradation that actually injures or kills an animal.
Part of this is about the intent of the law itself, correct? What was the Endangered Species Act of 1973 intending if it was not to address habitat loss, Adina?
Well, the goal of the Endangered Species Act was to conserve threatened and endangered species and the ecosystems on which they depend. So that is in the law. What is tricky about the Endangered Species Act is it applies to so many kinds of questions and so many kinds of practices on the ground and with really different kinds of species. So there's, you know, everything from bats and butterflies to
orchids.
Whales. Exactly. Yeah. And so it's trying to cover a lot, but really the Endangered Species Act is an end of the line kind of measure to try to prevent extinction. And so what I think we really need to focus on is keeping common species common, as well as trying to prevent these extinctions so that we don't end up in this situation. Now, Wisconsin has two species that have habitat conservation plans here in the state. And as I mentioned, you can take endangered species if you have a permit and a conservation plan in place. And these plans try to provide that regulatory flexibility so that people can still do a lot of actions on the ground without threatening the extinction of that species. So one of those is for the Karner blue butterfly, a lovely powder blue butterfly that likes to feed on lupine flowers and is mostly in central Wisconsin in the sandy soils. And the other is for bats in the Great Lakes region. Now, the bat story is a tough one because we have had white nose syndrome come in and take down our bat population to, in some cases, 1% of what it had been or even less. And that's especially been threatening for the northern long-eared bat. Actually endangering for the northern long-eared bat, which is federally listed as endangered. So then the question is, well, if there's only a few bat roost trees or hibernacula left in the state that have bats, how do we protect those trees without providing an undue burden on our loggers and our foresters who are making plans and our landowners? Because we know that these are really important and viable, sustainable industries. And so that's the goal of these habitat conservation plans, is to provide that balance and ideally a workable solution for everybody.
It sounds reasonable. Can you, Professor of Natural Resources Policy and Management at UW-Madison, Adina Rissman, our guest, can you take the position or explain the position of why to change the definition of harm and what that could benefit or why that would be in a priority of this federal administration?
Well, one of the interesting things about the rulemaking is they didn't provide a new definition of harm. They just rescinded the old definition and haven't proposed and in fact concluded that they don't need a new definition. So There's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to actually end up happening based on that or how the agencies are supposed to move forward. But certainly there's been a lot of concerns from a variety of interest groups who feel that they're overregulated on the ground, and maybe it's just that people don't want to deal with the extra paperwork or having to deal with federal agency staff who they may not have close relationships with on a day-to-day basis. And one of the things about it is that regulation, you know, doesn't always feel like common sense to everybody on the ground. And so when you have situations where people are saying, like in terms of forest harvest, it's not the fault of the timber industry that the bats declined down to 1%, right? There was this new emerging fungal disease that really wiped out the bats. And they're the ones on the ground who are having to now try to map these remaining roost trees and figure out how to prevent harm to the species going forward. And I guess I would argue that we should have an affinity for our endangered species as well as for our land stewards on the ground, folks like loggers and farmers who are making their living outdoors. And we need to have viable ways that they can really see the benefits of the good stewardship that they're doing.
So it feels like for industry, the onus could be on them to protect these endangered species, and maybe that could be misplaced. So if we don't place the onus on the industry, who would be responsible for protecting, defending these habitats and ensuring the populations of threatened and endangered species persists and the common species stay common, as you say?
Right. Well, I think to me, it's really an all hands kind of situation. We've seen a lot of threats increasing from habitat loss to changes in extreme storm events, the kind of smoke that affects us as humans also Sure. affects a lot of other species. So we see a lot of these threats, unfortunately, increasing. Meanwhile, we've seen some declines in the kinds of ways that we have to protect species, the kinds of funding and staff that are available to work on species protection. So I really think it should be an all hands on deck moment to come together and figure out how to put workable solutions into place.
Adina, finally today, what can we do to help out our endangered and threatened species in Wisconsin? If there was an action we could take or something we could do, what would that be?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot that people can do. There's been a lot of success stories. I was just out this last weekend on a boat and watched a bald eagle skim over the lake and go to its nest. And I just felt so grateful mm-hmm. that so many people have been working to conserve our habitats and our wildlife and plants for so long. I was also out this morning looking at my bee balm in my garden and noticing all the pollinators going to it. Promoting small things like planting pollinator habitat, as well as thinking about our purchases when we're buying paper, for instance, does it have that logo from a sustainability source like FSC or SFI that people might see on their paper package? And then staying active, communicating their values. There's a lot that can be done to help move things in a good direction.
Thank you so much for sharing this with us today and bringing us up to date and giving us the perspective from a number of points of view. Adina Rissman, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Adina Rissman's Professor of Natural Resources Policy and Management at UW-Madison. We'll turn next to Stan Temple, who is a professor emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. And as you're listening to the conversation, if you have questions, you are welcome to join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us to talk@wpr.org. And Stan, are you there?
I am. I'm sorry that it has to be under a situation in which we're talking about bad news for wildlife.
We are always grateful to have you join us, and thank you so much for being here today. And you've got a rather unique perspective on this because you played at least a small role in the lobbying that helped create the Endangered Species Act of 1973 in the first place.
Which gives you a clue how old I am.
But also gives you a clue of what stake you have in this game. And how. So give us a little bit of before 1973 and what was happening in the conservation movement and the attempt to protect our species that were threatened by population, diminished populations prior to the Endangered Species Act.
Well, it was during the 1960s that endangered species, and you might say the extinction crisis, really came to the forefront, both nationally and internationally. And in 1966, our federal government passed the very first piece of legislation that dealt with endangered species. It was called the Endangered Species Preservation Act. And it did a very simple thing. It said it was illegal to kill endangered species. It didn't address any of the most prevalent sources of threats to endangered species, but it did at least put endangered species on the federal legislative map. It was followed up in 1969 by the Endangered Species Conservation Act, which was it didn't do much more than the Endangered Species Preservation Act did. But the one thing that it added was it allowed the federal government to participate in international efforts to prevent species from becoming endangered and going extinct. And by 1969, and as you indicated earlier in the show, even 100 years ago, mm-hmm. conservationists were well aware that the main threat to species was habitat loss. And there was nothing in these two prior pieces of legislation that addressed the big underlying threat to species. So by the late 1960s, and specifically in 1969, when I got involved as a graduate student through a fellowship that let me participate in the lobbying, you might say, but the run-up to the Endangered Species Act of 1973. And the two things that were considered by the conservation community to be absolutely essential in this new law was, first, that it provide protection for the habitat that endangered species need, and secondly, that it do more than just take a passive sort of posture of just protecting the species from further harm, and instead put the emphasis on managing the species so that it can recover and no longer be endangered. So it was interesting for me. It was my first effort or attempt to get involved in federal policy and legislation. And I must say, in 1969, I naively thought, wow, this is not a big deal at all. Basically, the Endangered Species Act, as it was being proposed, was a completely nonpartisan issue. It was basically hardly opposed at all. In fact, it eventually, when the act actually was voted on, it sailed through the Senate without a single dissenting vote and sailed through the House with just a handful of dissenting votes. So it was a very popular, and still to this day remains, a very popular piece of legislation. And the two things that it did that were so key was protecting the critical habitat of endangered species and threatened species, and providing a mechanism for managing them to recovery. And Lee, you know, it's so blatantly obvious in the Endangered Species Act that it is the first thing when you read the text, the first thing you read is the purpose of the Endangered Species Act of 1973. And I'm going to quote this just because it is such a clear statement. It says, the purpose of this act is to provide a means whereby the ecosystems upon which endangered species and threatened species depend may be conserved, and to provide a program for the conservation of such endangered species and threatened species. So there they are, right in the purpose of the act, protecting habitat and providing for the management to affect the recovery of these species.
Overwhelmingly bipartisan when it was passed, and as yeah. Adina was talking about seeing a bald eagle earlier this weekend, and I couldn't help but think of, there's one of the animals that has directly benefited from some of the work that you put in and the result of the Endangered Species Act of 1973, and yet then changed last month on the what seemingly was a turn of a dime and a removal of a single definition of a single word and what is harm and what that means. I want to go to your questions now for our guest, Dan Temple, at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. And there is so much more to this story, so we'll continue, but I want to take a moment for David and Toma. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. I've got a suggestion to solve this problem, at least for Wisconsin, and maybe catch on elsewhere.
Go
ahead. If we could have a moratorium and/or prohibition on new permits for roads and sanitary permits, and that would eliminate building in the habitat and eliminate putting in new subdivisions and things.
What about the timber industry? Dina talked about that, and it certainly made me think that we're weighing, you know, the economic impacts of protecting our species.
Well, I think these would be major steps. And I think the timber industry can be regulated. That's a whole other topic. But I think these two items would have long-term beneficial effects.
But we've also at the same time talked about concerns over lack of housing, and the need for more housing was on a recent show. And we've got to build housing in Wisconsin. But would a moratorium or prohibition on these sort of licenses and contracts be a possible solution, Stan?
Well, it raises an issue of what can be done quite outside the realm of the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah.
And that is that there certainly are lots of things that could be done at the state and local level that would especially serve to protect the habitat of endangered species. The guest call-in mentioned a couple, but unfortunately, when we look at putting endangered species future in the hands of the state or the individual states, it isn't very workable because only a handful of states have the type of state-level legislation that allows them to really address the needs of endangered species. Wisconsin is not among those that has a very strong endangered species law. We do have one on the books, but it does not provide for protecting habitat. The other thing that is important about sort of shifting the burden to individual states and localities is that it never could possibly lead to a uniform protection for habitat or for the species across their entire range. Species, unfortunately, don't line up very well with political boundaries. And that means that if you're going to try to protect a species, you need to do it across its range, across multiple jurisdictions, not just sort of piecemeal.
And David, thank you for the call. And David's call makes me think of all the things that the Endangered Species Act is up against and why there might be interest in reforming this act or changing it through the undefining of a single word by writ of rule from the Trump administration. Can you see the argument on the other side of this, Stan? Is there a case to be made that maybe there is some way to, I don't know, compromise?
Yes, and it has been happening ever since 1973. Throughout the history of the Endangered Species Act, there have been a series of compromises that have allowed for potential conflicts between the needs of endangered species and special interest groups, whether that's private landowners or certain industries. But there have been ways for them to work out their differences with the protection of the endangered species. The first and most important of those is through the habitat conservation planning process. That means that if a project that requires federal approval has what appears to be an irreconcilable conflict with the needs of an endangered species, it is possible to get a habitat conservation plan, which basically allows the aggrieved party, not the endangered species, but the aggrieved party, to agree that we can alter the habitat of a species and allow our project to take place if we mitigate the losses by improving or creating additional habitat for the species or doing other measures that benefit the species somewhere else.
Stan, how long has that habitat conservation plan been part of the Endangered Species Act?
It was very, very early on, so that change took place, I believe, in 1978, so very early on in the process. So it was recognized, you know, that there had to be a way to resolve these differences. And since then, there have just been a whole series, or probably now more than a half a dozen different ways that private landowners or industry can resolve the differences that they might have with endangered species.
Stan, so, I want to take a moment here and just reintroduce you. I got to take a break, but when we come back, I want to look at all the different ways that the Endangered Species Act has evolved to adapt, to compromise, to make accommodations, and then the change that took place last month and what that could mean, not just for endangered species, but also for those that may be endangered or once were. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News. So a couple weeks ago, the Trump administration finalized a rule that redefines the Endangered Species Act of 1973 as we know it. It took the word harm and removed its definition entirely. Earlier, we spoke with Adina Rissman, who is a professor of natural resources policy and management at UW-Madison, about these changes. And our guest now on the Lee Rayburn Show is Stan Temple, professor emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, also a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation, and someone who had a small role in lobbying for the passage of the Endangered Species Act in 1973, which, as he says, was near unanimous and certainly bipartisan and not controversial at all. And it's been compromised, it's been adapted, it's been acclimated to industry and special interests since then to some degree. As Danielle Kading reports from WPR News, there are lawsuits that have been filed following the Trump administration's changing of the rule of the Endangered Species Act, which is to take effect in September, by the way. So what questions do you have for our guest, Stan Temple, and the endangered or threatened species in Wisconsin? Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. And Stan, I guess considering that the rule change now is in the hands of the courts, I'd like to take a look a little bit at what the courts have said in the past about the Endangered Species Act of 1973 and how they viewed this law as it faced tests with the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, certainly the Endangered Species Act has been challenged on a number of occasions. And, you know, there have been court battles almost from the very beginning. The first one came in 1978 when it became apparent that the habitat needs of a little fish in Tennessee was going to stand in the way of a federal dam project. And this went all the way to the Supreme Court in 1978. And the Supreme Court in 1978 ruled that it was unambiguous in the Endangered Species Act that the purpose was to halt and reverse the threats to endangered species. And the quote added on to that is important, whatever the cost. In other words, the Supreme Court said the endangered species will always win, essentially, in these conflicts. They have to be accommodated, whether they do that through compromise or not. The Endangered Species Act always wins. Well, that led to the creation, eventually, of what has affectionately been known as the God Squad. The God Squad being a committee that is appointed by whatever the current administration is in Washington to decide how these irreconcilable conflicts will be resolved. And the God Squad, since it was created, has only met three times.
Huh.
And now the God Squad is being called into action again as a result of these proposed changes to the Endangered Species Act. But there was more going on in the courts. In 1975, there was a major court decision. 1995, there was a major Supreme Court decision that had to do specifically with the definition of harm, including habitat destruction. And again, the Supreme Court rather unambiguously came out in favor of the Endangered Species Act and the protections that it afforded under the definition of harm, including habitat loss. So there have been a whole series of these court cases that have gone all the way to the Supreme Court in two cases that have generally stood up for the Endangered Species Act.
Well, and that stands out to me, Stan, because when we spoke to Adina Rissman, she suggested that the expectation is, or the hope is, for those who want to remove the definition of harm in the Endangered Species Act, is to make this back to the Supreme Court and perhaps change precedent that has been set, established, and reestablished over and over again.
Well, that's a tough one. It is a double-edged sword because there's often no way of predicting how the Supreme Court might rule, and especially because in 2024, the Supreme Court, in a ruling that had nothing directly to do with the Endangered Species Act, challenged, as a result of a challenge to what had been known as the Chevron deference.
Mm-hmm.
This was a legal opinion that in cases where there is a conflict between a rule proposed by the federal government to bring about the purposes of a piece of legislation, that the courts should always defer to the federal agencies unless it is just blatantly clear that whatever the rules are were made in error or were not defensible. So that had stood for decades, and in 2024, the Supreme Court ruled that the Chevron deference doctrine no longer applied, which meant that courts now plaintiffs could individually challenge rules in court, and the courts would decide the outcome rather than always deferring to the federal agencies and the rules that they've made.
Well, that's interesting. So the Supreme Court a couple of years ago changed precedent, shifting the authority from the rulemakers to the courts. And so yep. Now that the rulemakers have changed the Endangered Species Act of 1973,
right,
it'll ultimately be up to the courts as a result of this decision to figure out what that means.
That is going to be the case. And as I said, that the Chevron decision in 2024, it essentially opened the door for these changes or reinterpretations of the Endangered Species Act's rules.
And going back to what Adina told us is that, you know, they didn't redefine harm. They just removed the definition of harm. So now harm in the Endangered Species Act of 1973 is completely unclear.
And it will be up to courts to decide on a case-by-case basis whether whatever the action might be is to be interpreted as harm to a species.
So instead of having a blanket Endangered Species Act with these habitat conservation plans, you're going to have lawsuit after lawsuit that will be going to the courts, as you see it, Stan Temple, to define what harm may be for these species?
I'm afraid that is probably what the crystal ball says is going to happen in the future. And, of course, all of this hinges on legal action that's happening right now. There are literally dozens of lawsuits that have either been filed or will be filed challenging not only the redefinition of harm, but also some of the other rule changes that the current administration has made that affect the Endangered Species Act. So stay tuned. The courts are going to be busy with the Endangered Species Act for some time to come, but that in itself is harmful because it's going to play out over years.
Well,
and that means that for a long time, things will be in legal limbo.
Not just the Endangered Species Act then, Stan, the Clean Water Act. It could be any number of environmental protections that were put in place back as when you describe it, they weren't a partisan issue. They were passed with bipartisan support. I want to take a moment to go back to the whatever the cost quote from the Supreme Court decision in 1978. I've got that highlighted because I wanted to ask you why they decided, whatever the cost, that they needed to reverse the trend towards species extinction, that they needed to protect habitat. Did they decide this because the Supreme Court were environmentalists, or what was the basis for saying, whatever the cost, the Endangered Species Act of 1973 needs to protect the species?
It was strictly a legal opinion based on the statute itself, on the Endangered Species Act. As they said, it made it pretty clear in the statute itself, not necessarily in the rules that accompanied the act, but in the act itself, that we were dedicating our nation to preventing species from going extinct and that we should do whatever we can to prevent that from happening. So adding that, whatever the costs, to the ruling was very much in keeping with the way the Endangered Species Act intended our sort of legal system to abide by that pledge as a nation.
The intent of the law was clear, according to the Supreme Court in 1978. The intent of the law remained clear, according to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1995. And what happens next might depend on any number of courts at any number of different levels regarding any number of different species, which makes me wonder what that means for Wisconsin. I want to get to a call here, but let me reintroduce our guest, Dan Temple, Senior Fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW. Madison, and you're welcome here too at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Susie in Manitowoc next. Hi, Susie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The name of Stan Temple is well known in our household because our son studied with Stan, was in his class. And he is now with the Nature Conservancy as global freshwater scientist. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So, yay.
What a wonderful legacy.
We take great pride in the students that have gone on to do great things.
Yeah. Susie, do you have anything else for us today?
I do. I want people to know about this book, which was published to sell. It's called A Wild Promise, an illustrated celebration of the Endangered Species Act. It has an introductory essay by Terry Tempest Williams, which I've read multiple times. It's by Alan Crawford, who did beautiful photography and wonderful calligraphy, and it tells the status of each animal, whether it's still endangered or if it's been taken off the list, or all sorts of levels that an animal would be. Absolutely beautiful. I loved it so much that I wrote an essay in the front and said, you must read this, because we have four sons, and gave it to them for Christmas. It's an absolutely beautiful book.
Susie, thank you so much. A Wild Promise by Alan Crawford. Do you have a copy yet, Stan?
I do, and and actually, books like this, and there are lots that celebrate the amazing success of the Endangered Species Act. 99% of the species that have gotten onto the endangered or threatened list are still with us. We've only lost, you know, a couple. And significantly, many of the species that were on the list have gotten off the list in the very positive way that they've recovered, one of which, a species that I was very much involved with, the peregrine falcon. So the Endangered Species Act has this amazing track record of success. So the way Congress wrote it and the way the courts have reinterpreted it, have stood the test of time and seem to be doing a good job at their intended purpose. But there's a problem, and that is that once a species becomes threatened or endangered, we're often doing too little too late to help it. It's basically in the 11th hour, which makes it difficult for people like me who spent their career trying to design recovery programs up against a huge challenge. If species had gotten help sooner, it would have been a lot easier. And then you add to it our impatience, that we think that just because a species got listed and has a recovery plan, that magically overnight it's going to come off the endangered species list. And critics routinely offer this as a criticism, saying that, look, there are all these species that are listed that haven't come off the list. The Endangered Species Act, therefore, must be failing. It's no, the Endangered Species Act is doing its job. It just takes time. Often these species declined over decades or even centuries, and to imagine that we're going to suddenly get them back to a healthy status in a matter of years or decades is just completely irrational. It just makes no sense at all.
Susie, thank you for the call. Pardon me. And the recommendation, A Wild Promise, Alan Crawford, now on my list. Let's go to Jerry and Kokona next. Jerry, hi.
Yes. One of the things, we got an opportunity coming up in November to vote for Congress people who actually appreciate the environment and the outdoors and the wildlife. We have one here in our district, District 8, Mr. Weed, that doesn't give a hoot about the environment. And it's time to get people who vote your values and to put new laws in place.
Jerry, thank you for the call. And, Adina Rissman addressed the other side of this, that it's up against special development, it's up against industry, it's up against economic factors that have to have some weight in this discussion. It's understandable. Tim in Madison emailed us and wants to congratulate you, Stan, for what you've done for the Endangered Species Act. He also echoes Jerry's comment about the answers at the ballot box. People need to elect judges in Congress, people who care about natural resources. And you can't talk about policy without talking about politics, but the way you talk about politics, I think, probably needs to be carefully approached, because there are two sides to these debates, and we need to acknowledge that.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. And as I said, over the history of the Endangered Species Act, there have been lots of compromises, probably not enough. There probably do need to be changes to the Endangered Species Act that will only happen if we elect people to Congress who care about endangered species and want to make the Endangered Species Act even better than it is. Right now, there certainly are not enough resources being directed toward the recovery of endangered species. Ever since 1973, the Endangered Species Act has never, ever been adequately funded.
Huh.
And over just the last year, of course, the primary agency responsible for the Endangered Species Act, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, had its staff reduced by 20% and its funding cut by 32%. So these are changes that will make it even more difficult, but in addition to all these legal things that have been playing out in the background, just make it more and more difficult for the federal agencies that are responsible to carry out the mandate of the Endangered Species Act.
But the argument that we started with this hour had nothing to do with Congress. It was a presidential administration decision to alter a rule that undefined a word completely, and that word is harm. And I think it's worth asking how we define harm. And when it comes to understanding conservation as we do today, with the interconnectedness of our animals and plants and our habitat and our ecosystems, can we talk about harm without talking about habitat destruction or infringement? And I think scientifically, Stan, most folks would say the answer is pretty clear.
I think most people, you don't need a degree in ecology or having had taken one of my classes to understand that if you destroy or alter the place that an animal or plant needs to live, that you're doing harm to it. So, you know, quite the word common sense is often bandied around when we discuss changes in rules and legislation. And this one just seems to be common sense. And it seems like a real logical stretch, as well as probably a legal stretch, to abandon the notion that harm includes destroying habitat.
Jerry, I thank you for the call. Tim, thank you for the email, because when we're talking about policy, we are talking about politics. But when we used to talk about the Endangered Species Act, it wasn't a partisan thing we were talking about. But apparently maybe it is more so today than it used to be, like so many other things. And maybe we should take some time to think and talk about that as well. Let's go to Tanya and Stevens Point next. Tanya, hello.
Hi, I want to just thank you so much for your hard life work trying to protect, you know, the species that we have. And it is just heart-wrenching to see these things being undone today. And hopefully you just make more people like us stronger to stand up and fight against it and make it even better than that. That's all we can hope for, right? But I did also want to, I don't know if you know them or not, but I had the incredible pleasure of working for James Watrous and Emily Early when I was younger, and they were definitely in the National Crane Foundation. I think they were original founders of that or had something to do with that, and they were Mr. and Mrs. Watrous were wonderful people, and Emily Early would listen to Chapter of the Day when I was at her house cleaning for her, and that's what got me hooked on to WPR.
Oh, thank you. The Crane Foundation, the whooping crane's still on the endangered species list, right? And you also mentioned the piping plover is something that might be affected by these changes. I also think of the animals that have been delisted, like the peregrine falcon, as you mentioned, Stan the bald eagle, the Kirtland warbler, or the challenge species that may end up on this list as a result. What's the outcome of this change as you see it going forward, especially in Wisconsin?
Well, there are two things that change. We've talked a lot about the sort of redefinition of harm, but the other thing that changed by rulemaking was that threatened species will no longer be afforded the full protections of the Endangered Species Act. And that means that threatened species, these are species that are headed toward the endangered status unless we do something to reverse their downward trend, it means that more and more of these threatened species are going to become endangered. In Wisconsin, we mentioned that there were 25 threatened and endangered species. 16 of them are endangered and 9 of them are threatened. And among those 25 species, the ones that are likely to be most affected are species that have some relationship to water and wetlands, because many of our species depend on those types of habitat. So, for example, we mentioned the piping plover, which nests on the shores of the Great Lakes, prime real estate development, which would no longer be considered a harm if real estate development on the Great Lakes shore altered some of the nesting habitat for piping plover. Similarly, there are plants like the dwarf lake iris, which is found primarily in Door County. And it's found, again, in wetlands along the shore, prime real estate development. And again, it would no longer, those types of developments that might alter wetlands would no longer be considered harm to those species. The biggest group of species that are endangered in Wisconsin are actually mussels, freshwater mussels. We have 5 that just recently were advanced from threatened status to endangered status. They're just the most, have the most delightful names. Somebody had a whimsical view of clams when they came up with these names.
Stan, I'm sorry. We're going to have to return to this conversation another time. I have just run out of time with you, but I do want to echo Tanya and everybody else. I want to thank you for your lifetime of work, and I want to welcome you back here anytime. It's been a wonderful discussion, and I thank you for it.
Happy to do it.
Stan Temple, I'm curious about the mussel names now. We'll have to get back to that. Is a professor emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Thanks for all the calls and the emails today and being a part of our show. Thanks to our team as well. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News.